All right, imagine a world where you pull up to the gas pump. You got a road trip with the kids. Put the gas pump in the car, and you see this little label right there on the pump. It says, hey, use of this fuel product. It doesn't say, hey, it says warning. But I do think more warning stuff. Hey,
you.
Don't go through this door. It's going to make a lot of noise. Okay. The gas pump says, warning. Use of this fuel product contributes to climate change, which may put up to 30% of species at a likely risk of extinction. To learn more, go to wecandobetter.me. Right, and then that reminds you, all right, I'm out of cigarettes. So you go into the gas station, you buy cigarettes. No, listen, there is a movement afoot that suggests maybe we should be labeling gasoline pumps as being bad for people, bad for the planet, bad for the environment.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of people who want a lot of different warning labels on a lot of different things. I think there's this broader sense, and maybe that's getting a little out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe those are losing their impact, but this is about, I guess, trying to inform people about CO2 emissions, climate change, these sorts of things. I don't know that people are lacking for that information. I think it's certainly out there. I don't know what Joe Sixpack at the gas pump, where he fits in as a cog in this wheel, or what he can do about it.
Let's bring Rob Shirky into the program now, lawyer and executive director for Our Horizon. You can read more at ourhorizon.org. Rob, thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks for having me on the program. I appreciate it.
Well, it's good to have you here. And don't let me frame the argument the way I did in the preamble. Why don't you go ahead and put forward the idea here, since you're the man behind it.
Sure, thank you. And I'll maybe tell a story that I think helps to best illustrate it. So it was a little over a year ago. I was visiting my mom. So I live on the south end of Toronto. She lives on the north end. And I was visiting her for breakfast a few days in a row, trying to catch her on a morning when her fuel gauge was close to empty. That finally happens. And then I suggest, hey, how about I come over for supper later tonight? She says, sure. So I come over for supper. You know, before I go in, I go into her vehicle, check her fuel gauge, and I see the needle go up to full. So that's the real purpose behind my visit. I'm about to sort of run a bit of an experiment on her. And I ask her how her day was, where all did she go? And she says, well, I went to work, I got groceries, I came home. And then I say, okay, where else did you go? Did you go anywhere else? Same story, work, groceries, home, right? I ask, did you get out of your car even for a second, even, you know, when you were going between these places and so on? Same story. Questions get narrower and narrower until I ask her, by chance, did you stop to gas up at a gas station? And she says, she pauses, she thinks about it, and she says, yeah, I did. And so that's the context for this intervention. The thinking is right now, downstream. So when it comes to end users, people like you and I gassing up, just using the product, the act is so automatic, so habitual, it's been normalized for a couple generations. It's just part of the everyday fabric of living. For many of us, it doesn't even register as an act. And as long as that's the situation downstream, I don't think you'll ever see change, because we may not be, you know, verbalizing demand for this product. We may not be saying, give me fossil fuels, I want fossil fuels. But in effect, that's sort of, you know, the market conditions that we've created for it. So I tend to think of this intervention as one that gets that person at the pump to say, well, hey, what are my options? What am I supposed to do? And if I ask that question, if my neighbor asks that question, if my neighbor's neighbor, if an entire community, you then created a social environment that's more amenable to, say, a politician that's suggesting something like funding public transit. I think you're also incentivizing industry then, if there's a shift in consumer demand, to deliver some other solution to market. So it could be electric vehicles and so on. And through economies of scale, greater market interest, you're signaling opportunities for economies of scale, bring the product down to a better price point. So that's some of the thinking behind it. I think there's just a big disconnect. We get climate change. A lot of us, most of us hopefully know that it's real. I think the narrative that we have in our country is wrong. I think it's absurd for cars where I am in Toronto to be stuck on the 401 burning fuel that had to come from somewhere on the earth. And then we shake our fist towards Alberta and we say, shame on Alberta. Well, guess what? You know, we're buying it, right? There's a market for the product. So I tend to think, even when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, the problem doesn't come from extracting it or moving the product. It comes from burning it. 70 to 80% of emissions come from end use. So we really need to start looking at the demand side of the equation. I think if we're going to have any success in addressing climate change, this little sticker, this small, low-cost, perhaps lowest-cost intervention on the planet, being just a sticker, I think it's going to play an important role.
Well, I fail to see where it does. I mean, that I think that's my mm-hmm. thing here. I think, you know, your anecdote sort of leads to some sweeping assumptions about the motivations of consumers. And, mm-hmm. and those, you know, those habits are already being shaped by other factors. I mean, the cost of fuel shapes people's use of it. Obviously, vehicles are far more fuel efficient than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. That's only going to continue to be the case. Those things seem to matter a whole lot more to suggest that there's all this frivolous driving going on that people don't even think about or realize. I don't know. That seems like a risky assumption.
Yeah, and sorry, no, maybe I'm not being clear. And I wouldn't say that there's frivolous driving going on. So I'm not. While I do think, for example, this could nudge some individual behavior. So perhaps someone where public transit is an option might be willing to take that more often. Perhaps in the summer when it's easy to ride your bike, that might be an option. I'm more interested in how this changes the collective conversation on the issue. Right. Now, if you think about climate change, it's abstract. You can't see it. You know, a lot of the faraway consequences, just the nature of the beast, you know, we burn fossil fuels today. A lot of the consequences really are not going to be experienced until far down the road. So this kind of brings it a little more into the present, makes it a little more relevant, makes people feel more connected to the problem. You're creating social conditions that favor reform. So where I'm from, there's always conversations on, you know, we need better public transit. When it comes time to actually funding for it, that's where the conversation breaks down. If you can stimulate broader demand for these sorts of alternatives, you're giving a politician more license to actually implement that. So maybe this might be helpful, but if you think about it, sometimes people say, you know, if you build it, they will come. So Rob, all we need is better electric vehicles, more fuel-efficient vehicles, better public transit, and so on. I think that that expression is incomplete. I think what's closer to being accurate is if you make them want it, then you get to build it, then they will come. As long as there's this fundamental disconnect between end users and the cost of climate change, I don't think we're going to see movement on this issue, at least not on the timelines that we need to stave off, you know, the worst.
Well, when I mean, there's a direct correlation between what you're proposing here with putting warning labels on gas pumps and what we've seen with cigarettes, warning labels going on cigarettes, but there's a lot of people who will tell you that the primary motivator to them stopping smoking or not taking it up in the first place was the fact that cigarettes have become very, very expensive over the years. Gasoline has definitely gone up in price, but it's also kind of gone up in price with inflation, whereas cigarette prices have outpaced inflation. I think that when we talk about cost, isn't that the primary motivating factor here?
I'd say the cost is an important factor, and to be clear, you know, this is one of many pieces that is going to help us transition to a more sustainable future. There's no one silver bullet. What's interesting, though, is in the example of cigarettes, if one, you know, does want to make the price of gasoline higher, the fact is when warning labels were first introduced in the United States, that's where the idea originated in the early to mid-60s, a couple years later after it was introduced, excise taxes on the product went up, and that's because it was labeled as harmful, and it created this context that then allowed for many more interventions. So having said that, though, I mean, this could be a gateway to those sorts of interventions. There's actually interesting research from behavioral economics that suggests sometimes when you price what economists call externalities, or what we might know more informally as hidden costs, so we know that there's a lot of hidden costs to using fossil fuels. We melt glaciers. That causes a rise in sea level. That means that, you know, we then need to spend a lot of money to upgrade our coastal infrastructure. There's extreme weather and so on. So we know that there's these hidden costs. Sometimes in pricing them through carbon tax, cap and trade regime, and so on, at least in other contexts, what behavioral economists have observed is that you're actually then shutting off, you know, the moral cues that otherwise regulate human behavior. So the thinking then switches from, well, we need to conserve fossil fuels, use them more efficiently, transition to renewables, because we're concerned about impacts to species, to our children, our grandchildren, and so on, to, well, I've now just paid for that harm. We can carry on. I've almost now paid a fee for the privilege to pollute, right?
Right.
So it's interesting. This can even perhaps be seen as a bit of a complementary approach to it, where pricing mechanisms seek to disclose or convey, rather, these external costs of the marketplace through dollars and cents, this quantitative way. This idea engages consumers in a qualitative way through the use of image and text.
Does it do that, though? Because some of the wording seems vague to me. I mean, there's the cigarette pack says cigarettes cause cancer. This gasoline pump says may put up to 30% of species at a likely risk of extinction. So is it the fact that that the doom and gloom isn't necessarily there on these gasoline labels as it is on some other warnings that we see?
Yeah, well, so that language is actually informed by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the global authority on it. And so that's just the nature of science. It's predictive, and you can't say things with you know the same degree of certainty as you can others. So that's why the wording is constructed in that way. Having said that, though, I actually don't think we need to have a very graphic intervention. You'll notice some of the images I'm suggesting we use, and these are just mock-ups, you know, a picture of a caribou and then something that conveys loss of species in terms of text. The thinking is right now we're just so disconnected, end users are, to this problem, and establishing the connection, quite simply just putting it on a gas pump nozzle, making people literally feel connected to this problem, is what we need to do. As long as the narrative is, and this is where I think actually the environmental sector is wrong, so we tend to frame industry as the enemy. Alberta is the enemy. Pipelines are the enemy. Oil sands are the enemy. And I think to myself, I have family that lives in Calgary and works in oil and gas, some of the nicest people you'll ever meet, and they don't wake up every morning asking the question, how do I destroy our planet? They wake up, like we all do, saying, how do I provide food for my kids, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think our challenge isn't, you know, our enemy isn't this way we frame this narrative. Our enemy is really inertia. It's just status quo. It's, this is the way, you know, we've always done things. This is all I've ever known. And if you can disrupt that at the point of purchase and have a consumer sort of interact with this stimuli week after week, you're denormalizing this. You're kind of loosening the grip of the status quo, creating a better space, you know, more space to then transition to more sustainable alternatives. And I think there's room for a win here when it comes to industry, because the reality is the globe is decarbonizing. We know that we need to transition away from fossil fuels and embrace cleaner technology. The more we sort of double down and invest in unsustainable investments, the more we sort of invest in what could very well be inventory that just stays under the earth indefinitely, there's a loss there. If we, this little idea can be thought of as, you know, an early market signal, get us to shift investments to and interest to more sustainable technologies. If we can invest in that today, we can develop those solutions, you know, instead of then selling stuff that nobody wants down the road, we can then be exporting technology, Canadian technology that we'll have developed because we foresaw this transition and invested in it. So it's the classic, you know, don't skate to where the puck has been, skate to where the puck is going, right? If we want to win, let's just acknowledge reality. This is the time in which we find ourselves. Let's get real. Let's label these gas pumps and let's move forward.
But how real is it? I mean, the story over the weekend that China is now surpassing the U.S. as the world's biggest oil importer. Their demand continues to rise. That's not going to level off anytime soon. I don't know that the world's necessarily going the direction you say it is. The challenge, too, for a country like Canada is that we can't fix this on our own. So you talk about the cost that might present themselves decades down the road, and it's somehow a choice between the cost now or cost then. It seems to me that we get both. We're going to pay the cost of these policies you're talking about. That's not going to save us from the cost down the road of having to mitigate our shorelines, et cetera.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. And so the hope with this project actually is that it goes global. There's a great story in Canadian leadership on the tobacco warning labels. While it was created in the United States in the early to mid-60s, decades later, it was 2001, Canada decided to put a picture on it. And research actually shows that it's compelling. It does impact, you know, behavior and attitudes. Notwithstanding the fact that we can all point to our friend that still smokes, you know, when you look at the studies, they do have an impact. The more interesting thing is, though, is our innovation spread all over the world. So globally, and I've actually received emails about this project from people all over the world. Globally, there's an audience all over the world that's primed to get this. They understand this. People send me emails saying, this is great. This is just like what we do with tobacco. How do we get this done here? So the hope is that, and this is why I'm all in sort of, I'm now in debt. Like, this project is not funded. This is just a guy that's concerned about climate change that's trying to do his best. The hope is that if I can continue to push this forward, have it take root in communities across Canada, If I could do this, and the plan is then to sort of be in Europe and do the same over the fall and end up in Paris in December at this big United Nations Climate Change Conference, I would like to share stories of Canadian leadership with delegates from around the world and say, look at what we're doing, look at how it's changing the conversation on the issue, and why not bring it to your own country? And if you think about it, in the face of what many have described to be one of the world's greatest challenges, this is the lowest cost intervention. It doesn't get any easier than this. It's just a sticker. You know, why wouldn't you do it? So yes, you know, there are other countries that are more carbon intense than Canada. But the hope is that this ends up going there. So the game plan is actually to take this global.
All right. Rob Shirky, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Cheers. And thanks for letting me. I'd love to come on your program again to talk about this one day down the road.
Okay. Good stuff.
Cheers.
Take care, sir. Rob Shirky, lawyer, executive director at Our Horizon. Read more about this at ourhorizon.org. Quick pause here. We'll come back with some phone calls from you, 974-8255. It's Kincaid and Breckenridge on News Talk 770.